Is comedy dead? Can you even say anything without somebody getting upset with you? Anything at all? Do you like golf? Obama liked golf. Trump likes golf. I hate you because Trump liked golf or Obama likes golf. What happens when politics smothers everyday life? This week, we'll talk to Charles Lipson, the author of that piece, about what happens when somebody says something funny and everybody gets upset about it. Jeff Carlin is here, executive producer of the Rokan Show with Anna Devlantis and my friend and co-host. And I'm John Cass, husband, father, nationally syndicated columnist for the Chicago Tribune, member of its editorial board, and a lonely conservative floating on the sugar cookie in a raging sea of liberal milk. And you know where you are? You're sitting up there on the porch drinking some sweetened tea, hearing a southern senator from Louisiana telling a joke, and you're wondering, should I be angry or should I be sad? Should I hate him or should I like it? You're on the Chicago Way on WGN Plus.
Look, the Chicago Way is a deep cultural phenomenon.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man. There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand, defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso. In a tower by the river, Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago Way.
Our guest today is Charles Lipson, professor, University of Chicago Emeritus, writer for Real Clear Politics and many other sites, who had a brilliant column the other day entitled, When Politics Smothers Everyday Life. And he begins by talking about Senator John Kennedy of Louisiana, the earthy fellow with the great metaphors, who said,
I trust Russia and China and Iran and North Korea like I trust a Jussie Smollett police report. You can't trust them.
And all of a sudden, that drove everybody crazy on the left and some on the right. And Charles Lipson, what happened to this country where a man can't even give you an earthy metaphor, sitting on the porch sipping some sweetened tea or something stronger? What happened to this country, Charles?
It's a really sad thing to see the country so humorless about everything in our lives. But I was not only concerned about the humorlessness, but I was concerned about everything. There are people where you say, boy, wasn't it a beautiful sunrise? And a few years ago, people would say, yeah, I heard Obama say that, and I don't like it. And now they'd say, yeah, I heard Trump say. And everything is refracted through this political lens. I think there are reasons for that, but it seems like you can't even have a backyard barbecue without somebody either wanting to talk about vegan diets or the effect of the barbecue on global warming. Give us a chance to have a beer, man.
But in your piece, and again, brilliant piece, you write, what makes this divide, because everything's divided now, right?
Oh, yeah.
What makes this divide so dangerous is that we, meaning the American people, split along the same party lines on issue after issue. That undermines a crucial assumption of the nation's founding, set down right there in the Federalist Papers, which argued that our large republic would be stable because various factions would cut across each other. But that's not true today. A citizen's views on, say, immigration, likely to predict his views on guns, abortions, taxes, health care, school choice, public sector unions, and centralized government. Not always, but often. And it's true that across the country, the differences are amplified by the two parties, which use them to mobilize their base voters. Now, my concern has always been not with President Trump, but with his voters who have been marginalized and dehumanized, and when a when the cultural elites dehumanize 62 million people by calling them everything from rabid opossums to racists and Nazis, the result is predictably bloody and bad.
You are so right. And I'll give you a personal example, which is I said something exactly like that at a party in Hyde Park. It was just a cocktail type party. And I was talking with somebody and I said that I thought that it was a terrible thing and that people don't like to be called deplorable. I was talking with an educated woman in probably her 60s, and she looked at me and she said, but they are deplorable. But I don't want to place it all on one side.
No.
I think that there are places where you could go where you would hear exactly the same thing.
From the other side.
Exactly. So I'm not, nor am I saying everything is exactly equal, but we know that this has just gotten more and more vitriolic. And there's one thing that I find particularly troubling, and that's the idea of contempt. And I don't think, if you go back, and John and I are old enough, you're not, Jeff, but to a time when there was a loyal opposition and there was not a notion that the people on the other side were contemptible. And I think that it's a real problem.
Right, because sooner or later they'll whip out their canes on the Senate floor and start bashing each other.
People don't know that analogy and don't know that historical reference.
They don't teach history anymore, history professor Lipson. They don't teach it in school.
Watch out, I brought my cane. But actually, this was a case where I think it was South Carolina senator,
yes,
before the Civil War.
Pro-slave.
Just beat a pro-slave senator nearly to death on the Senate floor.
Right.
And we're getting closer to that.
Spank his PC no, as we said. He really tried to kill him.
So Bill Buckley, years ago, said, who would you rather be governed by, the Harvard faculty or the first 400 names in the Boston phone directory?
A lot of Adams, I'm sure.
I think it was the New York phone directory.
Aardvark. Aardvark extermination.
Acme.
Right. Acme, we know that they sell the best anvils.
Right.
I think that you want the professor from Harvard to maybe handle your air traffic control system. But we want, as a republic, to be able to make big decisions. What I was saying about the same divisions over and over again was that in the 1960s, political scientists, and I confess to being one, but I wasn't part of this, said, look, it's a bad thing that America has these sort of amorphous parties that are not so ideological, like the Europeans have a labor and, and you can vote on ideology. Well, we got it now, and the result of that is that we cut the pie each time along the same line. And what I said was, if we keep doing it, we're going to cut through the pan.
And I want to take 2 points with that. One, you shouldn't use a metal pan anyway, because it's always going to give you even bake. Go glass.
You always go for the
cast
absolute
iron
depth point, Jeff. That's what I like about your work, you know?
Yeah. Glass or ceramic if you need to.
But spread the heat.
But the other point is, I think you can see a correlation between the idea of gerrymandering and the way we draw our congressional districts, because there's so much power and money at stake, and it's become such a big business politics in its own right. There's never going to be the idea, well, I have to concede something, or you have to concede something, or we have to think what works best for all of us, maybe not perfectly for me or perfectly for you, but as a union.
What's that a function of, Jeff? Is it a function of our human nature, or is it a function of the fact that the Democrats through the left have basically wedded themselves to identity politics, cut everything up on racial lines, And as at the same time, the government is getting larger and larger and more intrusive into every aspect of our life, so that it's a natural outgrowth. This hyper-partisanship and division, isn't it a natural outgrowth of that?
Well, I think we've been herded as a populace into our corners, into our subsects of everything else, and then told, now you need to protect that. And the only way you can protect that is by listening to me. And that's become super dangerous. I mean, you want to go back to the founding fathers, the idea that we were just going to be a two-party system was never a thought. It was the idea that's that right. We would be maybe regionalized, or, you know, collectively in our beliefs on religion or where we were working, not in this vast swaths where you're either pro or con on everything, and that's how you're defined.
I want to say something about this notion of tribalism, which is so rampant.
And it reflects, it's part of your piece. I mean, it's part of what you're writing about.
But let me take you as an example, John. Nobody could be more proud of his heritage than you. That's not the same as the way that modern tribalism is organized. It's organized along one major cleavage. You're either in a victim's group or you are putatively an oppressor. And the only way you can escape being tarred with the oppressor, with all the consequences of being oppressor, you're still an oppressor. Your parents could have come over from the Soviet Union in the 80s, but if they're two white people, middle class, and so forth, you're somehow responsible for all the evils of our country's history. And our country's history is basically seen as evil. And our role in the world is seen as evil. But you can only make amends for that by essentially agreeing to whatever the victims groups have said are their grievances. But to be, just as might doesn't make right, powerlessness or group grievance doesn't mean the grievance is correct or the policy remedies are correct.
Hence, you have this woman in your story, part of that whole University of Chicago, Hyde Park intelligentsia elite, who then decries people as deplorables, or the friends of yours who were upset, as you write in your brilliant piece here in Real Clear Politics. And if you haven't seen it, just Google "When Politics Smothers Everyday Life" by Charles Lipson, when you quote Senator Kennedy, trusting North Korea and Iran and Russia is like trusting a Jesse Smollett police report, and people immediately go to their default position, as you were talking about.
Right.
Oh, I am not an oppressor. How dare you mention Jesse Smollett?
Well, was one of it. And the other was, this guy, John Kennedy, he supports Trump on a lot of things. How can you quote him? Well, it's irrelevant to that particular quote. And the quote itself wasn't racist. By the way, the funniest thing about Jesse Smollett, I don't know if you've seen Dave Chappelle. Oh my goodness.
Don't ever forget what happened to that French actor. You know what I'm talking about? Juicy Smollett. He's a very French, very famous French actor. One night, he was in Chicago late at night. He was the victim of a racist and homophobic attack. You see, Juicy Smollett is gay and he is black, not just French. Oh, it was a crazy story. Apparently, when he was walking down the street late at night, two white men came out of the shadows with MAGA hats on, beat him up, tied a rope around his neck and put some bleach on him and ran off into the night. International news. And everybody was furious, especially in Hollywood. It's all over everybody's Twitter feed and Instagram page. Justice for Juicy and all this shit. The whole country was up in arms. It was talking about it all the time on the news. And for some reason, African Americans, we were like oddly quiet. We were so quiet about this that the gay community started accusing African-American community of being homophobic for not supporting him. What they didn't understand is that we were supporting him with our silence. Because we understood that this was clearly lying. None of these details added up at all. If you're racist and homophobic, you're not even gonna know who this is. You can't watch Empire. Black people never feel sorry for the police, but this time we even felt sorry for the police. Can you imagine if you was a police veteran taking this kid's police report? Okay, Mr. Smullier, please tell me what happened. All right, 2 a.m. You left the house at 2 a.m. It's minus 16 degrees. All right. You were walking. All right. And where were you going? Subway. Sandwiches? That's when the men approached you? Did you see them? Do you have any? Okay, what do they have on? MAGA hats! MAGA hats on in Chicago? Excuse me one second, Mr. Smullier. Frank, come here for a second. Find out where Kanye West was last night.
We can't talk about this on common radio.
Right.
But we can talk about it here on the Chicago Way podcast. And if you like what you're listening to, you go on Google Play, iTunes, Stitcher, find it. On iTunes, you can write us a review. We'd really appreciate a 5-star review because you won't hear an intellect like Professor Lipson being able to talk for more than 5 minutes without being interrupted by traffic and weather on other stations. So back to this, Professor.
Which I have to defend are important things, messages of radio that require payment and are good for sales.
I'm
pay my salary. Just saying.
Just like Don Barzini said, after all, we are not communists.
But there was something I wanted to...
Oh, the okay. thing is, the default position of the woke scolds is interesting to me on this. The white woke scolds are trying to show their allies that they are not oppressors.
Right.
So then they condemn anyone who dares question Jussie Smollett or Smollett. Because even though the facts are in their face that this guy's a liar, they have to condemn anyone who would poke fun at him because it's like being told or saying in Salem that there's no witches. You must say that there are witches so that you yourself won't be burned at the stake, correct?
You can see the peacock's feathers spreading out behind these people as this sort of thing comes out. You know, pick your battles, man. Pick your battles.
It's that desire to express their fealty with the oppressed rather than being the oppressor that strikes me as humiliating.
There is historically and so forth genuine oppression. And in fact, I can't walk into these southern antebellum mansions. I know that they're built on the backs of slaves. And I feel a lot of times the same way about these great European houses, these peasants who in Russia or whatever had to spend their whole lives living in poverty level. But that's not how Steve Jobs got rich. That's not how Bill Gates got rich. These are people who added value to our society. There's nothing wrong with having two parents. There's nothing wrong with conveying to your children middle-class values. And the sense that people are lying when they say that there is how they want to raise their own families.
I'm sorry, Jeff, that I interrupted you earlier.
Oh, no. I was just, we were talking about the idea of, you know, not understanding the facts in front of you and seeing what the reality is. And John and I bantered about this a little bit on our own outside of taping, but we had recently Sean Spicer, who is unfortunately, you know, been just
Justin
haggard.
Pastels.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that, my favorite line with Jimmy Kimmel, if only ABC could embarrass and humiliate John Spicer more than the president. But the idea that he was in Chicago, paid to be here to talk at Northeastern Illinois University, and he and Donna Brazile were doing a discussion on stage, both well paid to be there, but their protests were out, and their protests were out there in the audience. They were hissing, they were booing him, they were calling him a liar during this civil discussion about from two very separate belief systems and how.
Were any of these people columnists who were hissing at him?
That I cannot confirm or deny, but the reality of it was that the argument for why people hated Sean Spicer or hate Sean Spicer is that he worked for the president and was a liar and did all these terrible things supporting someone who they could ultimately disbelieve. But the reality is that Sean Spicer is a dyed-in-the-wool conservative who is a stalwart of his beliefs in the conservatism and Republican beliefs.
Before Trump.
But okay. Right. But then he was tapped to say, hey, we've got, as the Republicans say, we need a countervailing force in the White House to help protect what we believe. And
it's not like Donna Brazile is, go ahead.
Right. And that's the point. All he was doing was what every White House press secretary has ever done. And it's spin. You can call it lying, you can call it spin, but it's the same thing. It's the idea of pushing your beliefs and tweaking it so the other side doesn't quite freak
out. I heard
the
audience there was the biggest audience ever in the history of. Yeah.
But what about Donna Brazile? To your point that.
Exactly.
Donna. Go on.
No.
Make it. No, you make it.
Well, the point is that Donna Brazile, who actively subverted our democracy by trying to pick Hillary Clinton as the nominee by feeding her questions.
And lying on CNN.
And lying on CNN. Right. And being absolutely disgraced and essentially run out of politics.
Lying on CNN is a job requirement.
But I mean, she orchestrated the establishment's response to support Hillary Clinton against Bernie Sanders. These kids are nominally woke, white woke kids who are Bernie bros screaming at Sean Spicer, but they don't have any animosity to Donna Brazile.
Well, let me say a couple of things. The first thing is, I think it's perfectly fine for students to protest, and there are right ways and wrong ways to protest. If you go outside the arena and walk around with placards saying Sean Spicer's a liar, perfectly fine. If you boo when he says something, that's fine too, unless you start to interrupt him, in which case you're suppressing speech, and that's a bad thing. I want to say something about woke. I've been reading about...
Are you woke?
Well, not normally at this time of day, but...
You've been woke since you began reading seriously, which was when you were probably about 12 or 13 years old.
There were great awakenings, religious awakenings in America, and they swept over the country, these great awakenings.
The Great Awakening, for example.
And there's been more than one.
Yeah.
And a lot of what you see now is a secular version of that. This is a kind of your views about the environment and immigration and all of these things have a kind of romantic, quasi-religious element of it. And it's not an accident that they say woke.
I anticipate another piece by Charles Lipton on this.
I'm dreaming of a woke Christmas, unlike the ones I used to know, where the police listen and quit filling prisons and Colin Kaepernick's a hero.
If we can bring Brazil and Spicer and what you're talking about together, it's the hyper-partisanship in our country terrifies me. Not that I want people to have views and I want them to have strong views and support their views and discuss them and debate
That's
them.
A key point. Support them.
Right.
But not an ad hominem. Your views are wrong because you're the wrong race or gender or...
Correct. But the frenzy that we're here, that I'm seeing, particularly in the deconstruction of not only Brett Kavanaugh, but the Supreme Court itself. The attitude that if the Supreme Court does not do what I want it to do, I will discredit and deconstruct this institution, like so many others are being deconstructed. Where does this come from? This is really important,
what you're saying. That was surprisingly smart, John.
Surprisingly, of course.
Now, the fight over the court is a very fundamental fight, and most people think that it's about Roe v. Wade, and for a lot of people it is about Roe v. Wade. But it's about something much, much bigger and deeper than only Roe. Not that I'm saying Roe is anything other than a fundamental issue for a lot of people, and they vote on it. In the late 1930s, when Franklin Roosevelt had already put forward a lot of New Deal programs, National Recovery Administration, and so forth, those were all found to be unconstitutional. And Franklin Roosevelt, when he won a re-election in 36, and he had the Congress with him, went on the air and he went directly to the court and said, look, if you don't change your decisions, I'm going to pack the court. By the way, you're now hearing that again. It's dumb. And the reason it's dumb is that there'll be a switch of parties in the future, and if there's no limit, then somebody else will pack it the other way. But and it'll delegitimize it like all the other institutions. But what happened was, it's normally taught in school that Roosevelt lost because he didn't pack the court. He actually won. The court backed down. After he made the threat, they started deciding every case in his favor. And then the people started to retire. They were older anyway, and they weren't going to go till they're 99, like they do now. And rather than resign during a presidency that they don't like. And the result of this was that there was a very substantial change in the kind of laws that could be passed and the kind of trotting on property rights and so forth. We think of property rights normally in an economic context. If you don't have clear or good property rights, how can you put up a building? And it's economic. But it's actually a constraint on what the state can do, because almost everything you think about, minimum wage or anything else, that intrudes on two adults making their own decision on what I'll take as a wage for a job or whether I can build an apartment here. So it constrains the state. What's at stake now, I think, is a lot of these issues. They're not going back to Calvin Coolidge, but a lot of what happens in our current system, John and Jeff, is that we're not governed by laws so much anymore as by regulations. By regulations. And what the law then says, basically, we want clean air. And it passes it off to the Environmental Protection Agency, and experts there, this is progressivism, experts there then say, well, clean air means X, Y, and Z. But our Constitution says you cannot delegate legislative authority. And so there are big issues that are going to come up here.
And that's Kavanaugh.
Exactly.
His history is to deconstruct that administration, even though he's a Bush appointee. His attitudes toward his judicial attitudes or legal attitudes towards the administrative state are quite threatening to the big left, big government, and maybe you're correct.
So I think this is a big thing, and there's another dimension of all of this. So I think that the fights, let's go back to the big issue about why people are fighting. A lot of people are fighting because they have a specific issue, abortion, one way or the other, or right to life. Or they just loathe candidate X, especially, you know, their very strong feelings pro and con about Trump. But there is also this deep division along the lines of how we should be governed. You made, and that I think is the deepest fight, but you made a really important point about our institutions. And one of the striking things that's happened over the last few years, there's been a decline in faith in all of our institutions. We've talked about this before, Jeff and John, But what's happened to the New York Times and to CNN, which used to be sort of viewed not in the same way that MSNBC was, or maybe the opinion like people at Fox.
Vanilla, yeah.
But at the New York Times, there's just been a meltdown. And the same is true, of course, at the Washington Post. A meltdown of what used to be a hard line between straight news reporting and editorializing. And I'd like you as a newspaper person, and Jeff, you as a person who's done a lot reporting and so forth, to tell me about how you were taught about that, what you think about that line, and what you think is happening to it now.
I've seen it through the lens of a development of like social media and the idea that mm-hmm. the personality or your opinion or your thoughts outside of what you're putting into a paper or a column or a report have bled across into your professional life. And I think it started, I mean, obviously there's the idea that there's bias and there's always going to be bias. And that's something that we teach about and how to avoid bias and how to turn your thought on its head and think about, you know, am I being biased because I'm not including that or vice versa? I think we ran into a problem in this country where the institutions that teach journalism or teach any of the media arts targeting people who are liberal on their own, just liberal, and they're a beacon for people being liberal because for various reasons, but they were attracting those people. And those people's opinions then became stronger and more amplified as they got into groups where it's a table of editorial members who are all entirely liberal, or a newsroom that's full of reporters that are entirely liberal. And that is drawn out. Well, I was taught it was your opinion means nothing to your reporting. You can be your own person. That's why I'm not active on social media. I don't do a lot of that because I don't want anybody to think of anything that I do through the lens of who I am outside of my profession, because my profession is to tell a story the way it is, according to facts.
The fall of journalism is a key component in the larger political mess we see. Part of that is economic. The old model has been attacked by the social media and the internet. Advertising has moved to the internet, Craigslist and so forth. The response has been, over my period of career, because that's when it's all happened, is that attitude began working its way into news analysis. And sometimes it's necessary. Right? Like you're writing about Ed Burke and Pat Hewells and the aldermen and the big roasts they carved up years ago. Part of that's necessary, but also I think what's happened is that it became commonplace that our own opinions, everyone has a navel, and some people just spend their careers gazing into it while others are expressing it. And I think it has led us, in this time of hyper-partisanship, to seek tweets and clicks, right? To be reinforced by this, in a bath of love by your supporters. And what that's done is affect the entire operation of news.
I think that's right. Let me throw out just a question. It came up as I was listening to you. There was a period in which newspapers began adding these sections, style sections, right, and cooking sections.
Used to call them the women's sections.
Right. They used to be, yes, that's
men
right.
Men had sports. Women had, we had like the tempo.
I believe lifestyle.
Lifestyle.
No, and those were changes when it became lifestyle.
But there were old guys with their white shirts and the sleeves rolled up, smoking cigars. Like Bernie Judge, who would run up to you and say, "Can you make it sing? We need a weeper on page one." You know, a weeper, right? Meaning, I go to the scene. I didn't work directly for him. I was his copy boy. But I mean, the idea is, you go to the scene and you write a story that ends up like where Doris Day would read it as the professor of journalism to Clark Gable, who's the editor, and pretends that he's really a night student. And she starts crying because the last line was, "I don't know. I just couldn't take it no more." And she starts crying. And I think Gig Young was playing the bongos.
"Now, Mr. Gallagher, I think I mentioned to you that the dean was greatly impressed with your news story. And he believes that anyone with your natural ability should be allowed the privilege of taking on extra work."
"That's the proposition?"
"Yes. Think of it. Why, it's a chance for you to practically cover two semesters in one."
No.
"Well, you'd have to have private instruction. Oh, I'd work very closely with you."
"Well, in that case..."
"Do you have any free time during the day?"
"No, I'm afraid we'd have to work together at night."
"All right. On your way out, Miss Fuller can set up an appointment schedule for you. Now, let's see. What sort of thing would you like to tackle next?"
"Well,
I want you to get the feel of investigative reporting. To learn to root out the hidden reasons and facts. Expand that piece you wrote. Do an interpretive follow-up of about 2,000 words."
"2,000? That's an awful lot of work, isn't it?"
"Yes, it is. But as my father used to say, a reporter has to do a lot of sweating before he earns the right to perspire."
"Hey, you keep mentioning your father. What did he do?"
"He ran a country newspaper."
"Well, of course, I don't know much about this sort of thing, but my friend I told you about, you know, the reporter, he says nobody's interested in a rehash like this. After all, it happened a week ago. Doing another story on it would be like trying to make a salad out of old lettuce."
Excuse me for saying this, Mr. Gallagher, but your friend's kind of reporting went out with prohibition."
Here's my question. As soon as you start orienting your newspaper to complementing the lifestyles of your readers, isn't it a short step to begin making your reporting complement their lives? I just wonder. I never thought about it until you were talking about it. It's why interesting conversation is interesting. But pretty soon, you're on half your paper. You're saying, "You play golf. Here's some suggestions. Here's a better way to do it. And here's a good course," which is part of our advertising and so forth.
Right.
"Or you love to cook cakes. We're going to show you how to make cakes." It's a little hard then to switch over to the rest of the paper saying, "Now the rest of the news, you know, blah, 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 blah,
Walter
blah,
Cronkite
real
style.
Hard right. nose news. And it sort of, you know, it's part of the Oprahfication also.
Uh-huh.
Of life. Everything's about feelings.
Yes.
In fact, it's funny. I hope people know about the Babylon Bee. Do you know about the Babylon Bee?
I do, and I would hope that it would be read by everyone in the country.
It's
a great newspaper.
It's like The Onion. Okay?
It's The Onion, but it's conservative.
But it's more sort of even-handed. It's more conservative. Yeah. And it was originally a kind of Christian, but it's, you know, you can read it even if you're apostate.
Right. And laugh.
And I posted an article from that the other day, and maybe this is one of the things that got me on this, aren't we humorless? And it said, feelings now to count in math scores.
But they do.
And somebody criticized me for posting that because they said, "Oh, this is a very conservative view," and I forget exactly what their argument was. It wasn't exactly an argument. It was more a kind of projectile vomit. But it was that, how dare you say that this was must be like the criticism of Common Core, and this is all part of a conservative attack on schools and so forth. And I mean, good Lord, it was a joke about our feeling society, and it was trying to juxtapose it to something where feelings are not supposed to be. I think imagination should count in mathematics. You should have an imagination, but there are answers, and sometimes the answers are wrong. And
same in economics,
you know.
Although it might be difficult. I have a question for you, sir. In terms of our politics smothering everyday life, what happened to comedy? And why is comedy dead, except for Dave Chappelle or a few others? But many find it extremely difficult. As you mentioned, the Babylon Bee, people get upset when you say math and feelings. What happens when comedy dies, and why is it that comedy is dying?
The first thing I always look for is evidence that what we're about to explain is really happening. So we're not explaining something that's false. And the marker to me is that the big time comedians no longer will go to college campuses where there's a lot of money to be made in front of an audience. And so why won't they go there? And the answer is because unless they were to tell old Bob Hope style jokes or Johnny Carson style jokes, which are pretty mild and not partisan, and the audience wouldn't like anymore. I mean, it's just that's not a matter of politics. It's just that's a matter of style. But in this woke environment, you couldn't tell even Henny Youngman's joke, "Take My Wife, Please." That would offend people. And almost everything about comedy does offend people in the modern kind of comedy. It's very much about, here's how I feel, and I'm going to discuss my sex life, and I'm going to discuss my girlfriends, and so forth. So it's very personal, and the personal is political. But if the personal is political for you, John, or for you, Jeff, and I'm in the audience listening to you, then the personal is political for me, and I can shout, you know, shut up. And to me, one of those, I always look, I'm not a novelist, but novelists are always trying to figure out a way to illustrate something large about the personality of the people they write about with something small. Okay. And I saw something at Swarthmore, which is one of the elite colleges. People who get into Swarthmore could get into Harvard, Stanford, University of Chicago, or vice versa. And it's at that level. They had a member of their board speaking to this small college. It's outside in the suburbs of Philadelphia. He is on the board of an oil company, but he's a trustee of this college, so he's giving them money and helping support it. And the students wouldn't let him speak. They were in there, and they wouldn't let him speak. Now, here's what the small point that was a big point. The dean of students and the president of the college were in the room at the time and said nothing. Okay, so they, in effect, they were either spineless or endorsing this kind of disruption.
Like Beto O'Rourke saying, we're going to grab your guns and step on the Second Amendment and the Bill of Rights, and the other Democrats saying nothing.
Yeah, right? It's very important. When he said that, by the way, I thought he is a person who does not think he has any future in statewide politics in Texas. But in any event, his only future is to be appointed secretary of pestering people in a Democratic administration, because he's never going to. This is a guy who doesn't have any policies, right? So he's never going to become. He can't survive a Democratic primaries. He's not going to be president, and he can't get elected statewide in Texas. It's a problem for people like Devin Nunes in California, right? I mean, he can't be elected statewide in California, so he got to win his district and be powerful in the House or be appointed to something nationally.
Back to the question, what did the philosophers think of comedy? I'm reminded of, I hate to say this, a movie, which is The Name of the Rose.
With Umberto Eco.
Umberto Eco's book, The Name of the Rose, was made, it was a good, great book, of course, made into a movie about where Sean Connery is playing this monk, middle-aged monk, at the time of the Spanish Inquisition. He goes to a monastery, he's uncovering, he's like the Sherlock Holmes of his time. A man of reason, but a man of faith. We could have both in those days, and still do, perhaps, a few of us. And he finds out that the entire murder plot, all this is about to protect, to not release a book that the monastery holds about comedy. I think it was one of the lost books of comedy by Aristotle or someone who had written about comedy and how important it is. It was destroyed. Yeah.
Most of the ancient philosophers were fearful of poetry and comedy precisely because they do undermine a lot of conventions. They play with conventions. I don't think that you could have a more incisive view of the Jesse Smollett case than what Dave Chappelle did. But he, in that comedy, he does some very dangerous things. And I don't mean to say
subversive.
He says in the Sticks and Stones Netflix special, he supports abortion. And you hear a lot of clapping, I'm in favor of this, blah, 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 you know, in the audience.
Woo, woo.
Woo. And he keeps going.
Dead babies, woo.
Yeah. Right. And then he says, but he says, to be fair, if you can kill the baby, I can abandon him. My money, my choice for the men.
Right.
Well, now the audience is sitting there in absolute confusion.
They don't know where to go.
And it's not clear whether he even means it or not, but I don't think I'd ever thought of it in that way. And George Carlin used to make these points all the time. There are pieces of George Carlin's I love writing. You do. I know, John. I mean, it's reflected in your writing how much you love it. And George Carlin has a piece about airline announcements as you're getting off. And I've never read any advice about writing that's better than that comedy routine. He begins with a line that says, where the announcement to you is, please look around your immediate seating area. He says it's a seat. It's not a seating area. And then he just goes on, and it's editing advice. Right. At one point, he says, please check for anything you might have brought on board. And he says, I might have brought my Arrowhead collection. I didn't. So I'm not going to look for it. And what you're seeing there, you could go to Strunk and White or any of the great advisors on how to edit yourself and write clearly and not come up with anything better. So my point is not these are the most brilliant people in the world. My point is there's often a lot of insight. A lot of it's politically incorrect. There's a scene in Stripes where the guy, psycho,
right?
He says, my name is Francis. Francis, whatever his last name is. And he says, but people call me psycho. You touch me, I'm going to kill you. You touch my stuff, I'm going to kill you. And then...
Because we all know a guy like that.
And exactly. And he just goes through all this, you know, posing as the toughest guy in the room. You know, he's going to slice you. And at the end, the drill sergeant turns to him and says, lighten up, Francis. And that should be posted on billboards all over Chicago, man.
Funnily, that's actually the great Jimmy DeCastro put that on a placard and gave it to all of us to hang in our offices.
No, really?
Ago. Yeah.
Lighten up, Francis?
Lighten up, Francis, for that very reason.
Oh, that's funny. I never heard that. That's great. Well, we all need to do that, John, starting with you.
You know what? When I do lighten up and I write satire. I get killed for it. Tom Bevan was on the last week or a week ago, warned me that satire is not good for columnists in the modern age because of everything that Charles Lipson is talking about in that great piece of his. Find him on Google. He's on Facebook. He has a Twitter handle called, what is it, Charles?
I hardly use Twitter, but it's Charles_Lipson. And periodically I'll do something, but I'm sort of half into social media and half not. But I do write for Real Clear Politics, and I have an author's page there, so you can find everything that I've written.
Thank you for being here, because I just love talking to you, man. I just love talking to you.
Jeff, John, you guys are great. It's so much fun, really.
Thanks for coming in. We love having you. The best conversation I ever have.
Yeah. It's like going to class.
Exactly.
But, you know, not going to class, but...
Oh, you're late with a paper, yeah, John. Right. I'm sorry.
It's like skipping class, but then going out for a beer later with your professor.
Exactly.
That's better. Thank you, Charles. And for you listeners out there, please find us on iTunes, on Google Play, Stitcher, wherever you find free podcasts, because this wisdom is free. Write us a kick-ass review, because reviews count in theater and on podcasts. And tell your friends about it. For Jeff Carlin, executive producer of The Rokan Show with Anna DeVolantis. For the great Charles Lipson, professor emeritus at the University of Chicago and author of several books and writer at Real Clear Politics. And for me, John Cass, husband, father, syndicated columnist, nationally syndicated columnist for the Chicago Tribune, a scourge of the left, member of the editorial board of the great Metropolitan newspaper. This has been The Chicago Way on WGN+.
Lighten up, Francis.